All right, so we're recording the review for Sefer Shmuel Bet, which is happening for the spring semester 2019. That's a number which really blows my mind. Anyway, it really blows my mind. The review session really divides into two parts. Number one is sort of the general, what I call the boring stuff, and then a bit more on the page. If some of you need a page to write on or whatever of the review sheet, didn't have it on your tape or on your desktop or whatever, it is available over here, so please help yourselves. So before we start, I just want to say a few things in terms of the exam itself. It's six questions of which you have to do five. I've only got two copies, I'm sorry, I mentioned that. I wasn't able to bring more. I mentioned that last time. But you all should have a copy of this. The general exam technique discussion usually revolves around a number of things. Firstly, five out of six questions to be answered. Do not be brave or foolish or whatever word you want to use to do six out of six, because all will happen is question number six, whatever it is, won't be number six. The sixth question will get a nice red line, blue line, black line, whatever colour my pen is. Sorry? Any answer you give beyond the five questions will be ignored.
Well, I'm saying it's five out of six.
Five out of six, which you have to answer, but I'll talk about the length of answer in a minute. excuse me. In terms of the questions, and this is probably the most important thing that what I'm going to say, is that every question has parts. A, B, C, sometimes A, B, C, and D. And most of the questions are based on the information. There's occasional thinking questions. You know, I can't stop myself from getting you guys to think a little bit. Why not? That's part of what the exam is about. But mainly based on the information that we've covered. And please, please do not fail to answer five questions, because you immediately reduce your chances of getting a decent grade. And more to the point, do not fail to answer any part of any question. Okay, if you want to do the whole question in one answer, for instance, make sure you point out to me that this is the answer to section A. Just write, you know, in a bracket, answer to section A, section B, section C, section whatever. So make sure that I understand that you're answering the whole of the question, even if you do it just in one paragraph, all right, or whatever. Don't hesitate to use those horrid little books either, as much as you can. Do not write anything on the covers. I always get annoyed when that happens. Please do not write anything on the covers apart from your name. Right? That's on the blue books. Certainly not to start writing answers to questions. As I mentioned more or less every time, some of you heard this before, young lady who's probably now a grandmother. In my other lesson, she was only a mother, but I've now decided that she's a grandmother. Who knows? A long time ago, who decided to write the whole answer on the back cover of her answer book, meaning starting on the blue cover at the back, inside, finishing on the outside cover. Amazing. With 1 millimeter left, she managed to get the whole answer down. Quite breathtaking. Work of art. Should have been sent to a museum, I guess, but certainly not something that I would recommend if you want to endear yourself to the professor, in this case to me. Please don't do it, right? If you need even for one more word to take another book, do not hesitate, because those awful books, I think it's a mitzvah to actually use them up. It's one of those things which they seem to reproduce at an alarming rate. More and more of them seem to appear every time. Saying that, I would say also, if you want to use one side of the page, not two sides, up to you. I don't mind if you write on both sides or you just write on one side. You know, you can use, because essentially the number of books that you use is, you know, really your decision. Some of you like to write small, some of you like a little bit bigger. Try and make it as eligible, I'm thinking of Shidduchim. Try to make it as legible as it possibly can. Can be eligible as well, for different reasons. You know, don't want to talk about that. Here's our time now. I just had my grandson's bar mitzvah, so my mind is way away, which was really nice. It was beautiful, but very exhausting, as you can imagine. A lot of eating. Very, very hard to sit there and eat so much food. But I made the effort, I assure you. Thank God. The big thing is, again, getting back to the exam, is to obviously, you know, sort of try and present a neat presentation. Again, colors to be avoided. No pinks, no beiges, no light yellows in terms of pens. I always tell the story of a young lady who wrote her answer in some sort of color that was only visible in the dark. It was quite amazing. It's absolutely true. I had to read it under my blanket because I couldn't see it. Unbelievable. Where did she get a pen like that from? I do not know. Black, blue, pencil. But I would say to you, pencil, I had an exam, actually interesting, last semester, which was written in pencil, but was very light. And the person didn't press, and that was very hard to read. So again, if you're going to use a pencil, make sure that it's legible. Not just to you, but to everybody who sees it, that it shouldn't be too light. You know, there are different pencils, HB and HB2 and all the rest of it. Make it as strong a lead as you possibly can. All right, so that's the two tales of woe that I like to tell. Oh, tale of woe number three, do not get yourself into a difficult situation by preparing an event after the exam which clashes with the exam. The young lady, again, must be well into her 30s by now, who arranged a flight to Israel 2 hours after my exam. Exam finished at 3, she was on a plane apparently at 5, taking off at 5 from JFK, which means that she had to be at the airport by 3. Not a good idea, unless you're a Star Trek sort of fan where you can beam from here to there in 1 second. Please do not do that, right? Give yourself plenty of time. If you're going anywhere in the evening, if you're on a date or you're going to a wedding or whatever, make sure you're not pressurizing the exam to rush it, right? Usually takes it's a 2 hour exam. The average time is about an hour and a quarter. So if you take a bit less, a little bit more, obviously if you need extra time, you have that arrangement, that's not a problem. And we'll deal with that on the day, a case-by-case basis. If you finish within the 2 hours, fine. If you need more time, the proctor sits downstairs on the sixth floor and will go down there and deposit you, if that's the expression, in that room to finish your exam. Also, I just want to mention an order of questions, that you can do them in any order, right? Don't have to necessarily do them 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Very much the way you want to go. But again, I stress, answer every part of every question. Really, really important. Any questions on this, what I call the boring stuff, but entertaining at the same time? Books to bring in, very important. Hebrew, English only. I'll take your question, Alana, in just 1 second, let me finish this point. Hebrew, English, meaning JPS or Koran, if you understand what I'm referring to. Those types of English, Hebrew translations, absolutely fine. But not anything with commentary like the one that we've been using, the Judaica, or Art Scroll with the commentary, but you can do the Art Scroll plain, the big green book, okay? Or some of them a bit smaller, but there's the whole Tanakh in translation, Hebrew, English, absolutely accepted. But anything more than that, not. But if you have a Mikrot Gedolot, Hebrew only, which you like to use, then quite acceptable to bring that in to the exam. Don't have an issue with that.
Do you recommend us bring this in, or
I would absolutely recommend it, because my next comment is, when you use text, I'm not looking for big chunks of text, but I would say to you, if you use any sort of text which is like a phrase or something like that, and you quote from the text, that will make me a very happy camper. If you don't use the text, then it makes me not unhappy, but less happy. Okay, I see the text and I get the feeling, wow, this sefer really registered with you, because you're quoting me a phrase. It doesn't have to be more than a couple of words, but it shows that you're aware of the text. And that is really, for me, very exciting, because it means that something's registered. Shmuel Ben, fantastic sefer. I mean, I hope you realize that. It's a phenomenal sefer. We didn't quite finish it. One chapter that the time beat us, but I hope you will read it to yourselves. You won't get a question in the exam on it, but the whole sefer, learning about David HaMelech. Right, a man who lived in this world, but what a tzaddik. At the same time, what a human being. Right, that's the whole thing with Batsheva, which we'll talk about in a minute. Question, yes, Ilana.
Are you giving an exam in the L slot? Because the PQ slot for the exam is together. And if you have a class with a Q, I have to take it in the L.
Any arrangements like that, you have to speak to Dr. Katz. Right, she will organize your changes if they are acceptable. I can't make any suggestions on that. I'm not giving L, I do M. So I will be available solely for the This one is a P, right? So I'll be available for that. But I'm not doing anything which clashes with that. But if you have a specific request, she is the address. Speak to her and see if she can help you with that. Sometimes she does, sometimes she doesn't. You know, it depends on the situation. Okay, so have that conversation if you have to. Yeah?
It's in Kach,
I can't tell you till the day. I hope not, because that place really... I don't know, I just get choked up with the dust in there. It's a very dusty place. But saying that, if it is, you know, normally what happens is they're missing proctors, so then they put everybody in there, 500 people, and it's a real pain in the neck. So what I would say to you is, if we are in there, please just all sit in one row. All right, you're not a large group, so sit in one row to help me out, and then all the other proctors can sort of do their thing without trying to sort of see you in one corner and then somebody else in the other corner. It gets very complicated like that. So, I mean, you know the routine, so I'm sure you'll do that. Yes, Sharon.
You said that you recommend us for a Navi of some sort.
Yeah.
We have like a Tanakh, but it's only Hebrew. Is that okay?
Yeah, absolutely. Sure. Anything only Hebrew, I don't have an issue with. What I do have is with a Hebrew English, like the Judaica that we've been using, with commentary. Because I can't really allow that.
Do you need the commentary?
Do you need the commentary? The answer is that it may get help in answering questions, so I can't allow that in. But you will, I just so recommend bringing a text. Either bring it or getting hold of one. There's some in the Beit Midrash, and there's always books flying around. The worst case scenario, to borrow it from the person sitting next to you.
But it doesn't have to be Mikraot Gedolot.
And the Mikraot Gedolot can come in as well, but again, Hebrew only, no problem. Okay? But when it's Hebrew English, it's got to be the basic translation and nothing else. Yes, Chaydin.
Can they print it out from like Chabad?
Yeah. If you print it out from Chabad or from Safaria, which is the one I recommend, it's better translation, then absolutely no problem. Okay, so if you want to do that, a lot of pages, but you know, it'll be something that you can actually then keep and, you know, do something with it. Don't sort of leave it behind. Was that your question, Khana? Same question?
Yeah, I'm going to ask if we can have English.
Yeah, English only, meaning Hebrew English translation, and that's it, but nothing more than that.
What if you like write notes in your book?
Doesn't matter if you have notes in there, if you do highlighting or whatever. I mean, don't write chunks in there. You won't have room in a normal Tanakh. You won't have room. Yeah, it won't be much room to write anything. But if you want to highlight, for instance, I have no problem with that either. Right? You say to yourself, oh, he's always going to ask a question about Dovin and Batsheva. What would be the text that I should highlight in that particular thing? And if you do that, you know, you've really done a great preparation for the exam. So, even if you want to highlight that, I don't have those issues. I don't have an issue with, but I can't allow the English commentary. That's something that's a little bit too, you know, sort of allowance has to stop at a certain point. Any other questions about the exam before we go into the syllabus? Yes. Again, I would avoid that if possible, but to highlight, I don't have an issue with. Right? I would leave it at that. If you print out Sfari, I don't want you to come in with notes, because that obviously is not the idea of the exam. It certainly should be without notes, but can be with text. That's the sort of level of the exam, which I think is fair. You know, I don't think that's an unfair request. Okay, in which case, let's hit the review page. Number one, Story of the Amalekite Boy, Chapter 1 of Malachim Bet. Right, the big issue there is the comparison between chapter 1 of Malachim Bet, Shmuel Bet. If I ever say Malachim in this lesson, I mean Shmuel. Chapter 1 of Shmuel Bet with chapter 31 of Shmuel Aleph, where the same story is told, but different. Right, in chapter 31 of Shmuel Aleph, it says about the death of Shaul, and it tells us quite clearly that he committed suicide, which is a whole discussion for another time. Whereas in chapter 1 of Shmuel Bet, the Nar Maleki comes to, you know, the young man comes to David to tell him what he considers to be the great news, that Shaul is dead. And not only that, but he contributed to the death of Shaul. So of course, David, instead of rewarding him, goes completely ballistic, because he says, how can you even admit to me that you've killed the anointed one of God, Bechir Hashem? David had such respect for Shaul, one of the great marks of David as a tzaddik was the way that he could overlook Shaul's depression and just love the man more than you could ever imagine. He just has such respect for him. He had love for him, and Shaul didn't show it in return in many cases, but there are glimpses where even Shaul returns that particular feeling towards the end of Shmuel Aleph. And no question about it, to admit that you killed the king was not the thing to do to David, and he immediately pronounces the death sentence on the person. He considers him a Moreid b'Malchut, a law of the king, which is that if you're a rebel against the king, meaning not necessarily against David, he's not the king, but against Shaul, who was the king, by killing him, you are liable yourself to be killed. And that's what David pronounces, and the young man is executed. Now again, one of the things that the commentary, I don't expect you to remember the names of the commentaries, but certainly what they say is the Radak. We spoke about the Radak on that particular story, because the Radak asked the obvious question, the two accounts of the same event are different, right? So how do we explain that? And he lines them up, either to say that there's not really that much difference between one and two, or we can say that in fact, number one is the real account, and number two is the young man's account, which obviously he tailored towards his own requirements. He wanted to score points with David to get a reward, and that wasn't going to happen. Okay, so account number one is correct. Account number two was in fact false, or not quite the truth. False, fake news, as they would say today. And the reality of it was that instead of getting a reward, David gave him the punishment, which really he was due to him. And there's a whole discussion, because he's from Amalek, the irony, of course, originally that he's Amalek, whether he's considered to be Jewish, I didn't really go into that, but that's a whole area by itself. And more to the point, the irony of Shaul failing to destroy Amalek, being, according to this account at the beginning of Shmuel Bet, being killed by an Amalekite convert, right? Because the young man is converted, but he claims to have killed the king. It's a big irony in that.
Can you talk about that irony, or did we just talk about
it? I think we've just mentioned it, but it does come up somewhere. I read it. I can't tell you where. Yeah, and I think that's the story. It's just an interesting thing, or a note. That's all as much as I want to say about chapter 1. And it's pretty sad, but of course, by the end of chapter 1, David is king in Hebron. He's not in Yerushalayim yet. So let's get clear where David is going. Number 2, Avner. Background to Avner, the kingmaker. So firstly, who is Avner? He is the uncle of King Saul. Right? Shaul's uncle. Uncle Abner. As opposed to little Abner, which I believe was a character on the comic world of this country. Was there a little Abner? Ask your parents, there probably was something like that, because I'm told that he did exist. This is Uncle Abner. And Uncle Abner was very powerful. He was the head of the army. He was there in the Haftarah. Interesting, last week we read chapter 20 of Shmuel Aleph, and Abner is sitting there on Rosh Chodesh with his nephew, with Shaul, when David doesn't turn up. The whole famous story there with the Arabs. And it's just a phenomenal character. Abner is always going to be the power behind the throne. He's the one who brings, seemingly, certainly supporting Shaul, and more to the point, he's the one who brings Ish-Boshet, the son of Shaul, who we just have not heard of, till he appears. We don't have any inkling that he exists in any of the chapters of Shmuel Aleph, but he does appear in Shmuel Bet. And Ish-Boshet becomes the king through Avner's intervention. It's very sad because Ish-Boshet doesn't really want to be the king. He's not built to be the king. He has various issues, physical issues, which he has to deal with. And as a consequence, the whole enterprise is very bad. Also to mention with Avner that he represents the side of Shaul as reflected by Ish-Boshet when it comes to that tremendous fight that goes on between the two groups of young men, 12 and 12. And obviously the symbolism is between 12 and 12, obviously each one representing the tribes of Israel. So you have that awful wrestling match which turns into a bloodbath, right? All of them are killed, they kill each other. That's chapter 2 of... Sorry, Avner is initially with Shaul, meaning Ish-Boshet, the son... It represents Saul, meaning the son of Shaul, represents Ish-Boshet. And against him is Yoav representing David. Okay?
Abner is on Ish-Boshet's side. And he
correct.
This whole
at thing. That at that time. At that time.
But does... Okay, so Abner mostly is on... Is against David.
Is against David. Till he changes
until
his mind.
Changes sides.
Correct. Now, what happens in... an interesting, just something that occurred to me that I noticed is that you've got Av in the name of Ner, and you've got Av in the name Yoav. So that in itself is a way of remembering. These are very fatherly figures, meaning they are
Av Shalom.
Yeah, it's interesting that that word Av is not just by chance. It shows either wannabes or the real deal.
It's interesting because Yoav, Avner, and Avshalom are all people who opposed David at some point.
At some point. Very fascinating. And of course, you go back to Sefer Shoftim, there was an Avimelech who also was opposing essentially the whole setup of the Shofet. You know, this name with the Av in it always has a certain inclination towards doing something of major proportions, unfortunately, usually for the bad. Yes?
12 against 12?
Yeah.
They all died?
Yeah, they all died, 24. All of them.
And why did it represent the Jews?
Yeah, because there were two sides fighting for leadership, the side of Shaul, who Shaul was dead, but his son was taking over, as directed by Avner, and Yoav, who was the nephew of David, representing the new king, David, right? His group. And these two groups met at the Brechat in Givon, if I'm not mistaken, and they have this terrible, it starts off as a game, but it becomes a bloodbath, they kill each other, and that starts a war which goes on for a period of time where many, many people are killed. Eventually, of course, what happens is, just to finish number two, you get to chapter three, and the war gets worse to the point where Avner decides, I'm going to change over sides, Ishbosheth, I can't support Ishbosheth anymore, and he goes over to the side of David. Okay, and the one who suspects him more than anybody else, of course, is Yoav. Yoav says, you know, what are you doing here? You're the leader of the enemy. How can you now be supporting David? David himself has great respect for Avner. He respects his authority. He respects his seniority. But unfortunately, Avner, remember, eventually is killed by none other than Yoav. Yoav takes it upon himself to kill Avner, and that is the end of the story. They're discussing chalitza. Remember that whole thing, taking off the shoe, doing it without your hands, doing it with your teeth. Very strange halachic question that they are talking about. But in the process, Yoav is able to get Avner off his guard. Remember, Avner's a soldier, so he'll be aware of what Yoav might do. Yoav kills Avner. Now, Avner, before that, managed to save himself from Amasa, who was chasing after him because of the death of Asael. Right? It's not Amasa, it's Asael. Let's get it clear. Avner kills Asael, who is Yoav's brother.
He's the fast one.
And he's the fast one who tries to catch Avner after the war, seems to go for the side of David against Avner. And in the process, Asael is killed. So, of course, the brothers, the other two brothers, Yoav and Avishai, all the three brothers in total, nephews of King David, take upon themselves to revenge. And Yoav does it. Yoav gets Avner in a corner, asks him this rather strange question, which Avner takes at face value, and the next thing you know, it's a sword into the fifth rib. Fifth rib, if you count your ribs, it's round about the heart. Not a very good situation, and your Avner is dead. Avner is buried in Hebron, so if you ever go and visit Hebron, you should not only visit the obvious place, the Marat Machpelah, but there actually is the tomb of Avner, which is still, you can get there. I'm not sure whether you go there every day. You might need a soldier escort, but now that you know about Avner, it certainly is a place worthy to go and daven there, because, you know, we know a bit about him. Many people go to Israel and don't really know who Avner is. Thank God we do. As I said here, the kingmaker. And he really was the kingmaker, a very special man. And David mourns him. David says a famous hesped towards Avner. He has a sense of respect for what Avner represented. Number three. Yes.
What chapter did Avner change
sides? Yeah, chapter three. Okay. And just to add to the end of the story, of course, by chapter four, Ishbosheth is killed. He's assassinated again. Two people come and try and kill him. Go to David to announce the good news, and of course David again is very upset. Ishbosheth, he says, is a tzaddik. How can you kill the tzaddik? And again, they are put to death. Two men who try to get the kudos, and in the end, pay with their lives. Quite amazing. Chapter 4. Sorry?
He eulogizes both Avner and Ishbosheth.
Yeah, he eulogizes particularly Avner, and he is pretty... well, Ishbosheth, when eventually Ishbosheth dies, certainly David, we're not told about a eulogy, but we're certainly told about his comments about Ishbosheth. It seems to be that David had a study partner called Mephibosheth, the son of Yonatan, but there is a suggestion that he also studied and learned with Ishbosheth. So Ishbosheth was pretty major. You know, nowadays he would be someone who would be a research sort of guy. Certainly would not be an authority sort of guy. But when you've got Avner pushing him, not a lot that he could do about it. Yes, Hannah.
Are we to assume that Ishbosheth was killed because Avner wasn't there to
Yeah, seemingly. Avner was already dead. And Ishbosheth, there was nothing to save him.
Avner was almost like a bodyguard.
Yeah, like, yeah. Yeah, the bodyguard.
Avner wasn't on his team, kind of lost all that.
Well, Avner by that time had switched over to David.
Right, but when Avner left Ishbosheth, he like lost all his validity.
Correct. He lost his validity. Avner was the kingmaker. He was the. If you had Avner's support, you had a chance. Without it, curtains. Absolute curtains. David and Michal, their relationship, again, someone wrote a very nice essay. Oh, Elisha just wrote an essay, which I saw, about that whole discussion. Tragic. Absolutely tragic. Initially, very much in sort of in harmony with each other, but by the particularly chapter 5, when you read chapter 5 and 6, chapter 5, the conquering Yerushalayim, and then chapter 6, bringing the Oron to Yerushalayim, David displays behavior which we could only describe as something you would see in Crown Heights on Simchat Torah, and the poor lady, Lady Michal, being a woman of great breeding of the royal family, decides that this is unacceptable. How can the king behave in such a frivolous manner? And she gets very upset with him, and of course, their relationship from there goes completely out of the window. It says later on that David never had kids with her. He had a child maybe before that, the suggestion is, but not anything afterwards. Although she does remain seemingly in his favor, but they never really lived together after that. She could not stand the king, the future king of Israel, demeaning himself in such a way in front of the Oron when David was just doing his Simchas Torah thing. Very different hashkafot. So their relationship was really, in the end, very tragic. Right? Initially, it was amazing. She helped him escape from the king, but by the end, she Michal and David just did not connect. They didn't see eye to eye. Very, very sad. Yoav and his interactions with David throughout the book, that's a very big question. I can't give you chapter and verse on that one, except to say that it's a hot and cold relationship. Right? Yoav, at certain times, shows tremendous allegiance to David. What's one of the biggest things that he does for David? Not necessarily one of the greatest things he does, but one of the biggest things he does, is sending Uriah on the command of the king to the front line. In that story of David and Bathsheba, even though it wasn't necessarily the greatest thing that he could have done, because obviously that was killing Uriah in the course of the story, but his allegiance to David is absolute.
Seems like
he does have a certain practical skill, which... there may be other things that we can look at and try and find. Yoav is always going to be the one, and that's a phrase that you can find at the end, I think, of chapter 3. I'm pretty sure it's the end of chapter 3, when David talks about the sons of his sister, his nephews. They are kashim mimeni. Right? That's, I think, in chapter 3 at the end there. It says that they are very harsh. David is almost admitting that he's afraid of them. He's afraid of Yoav. He's afraid of Avishai, and when he was alive, Asael. But Asael disappeared very quickly. Not really. Avishai is the one that probably worth remembering. But again, it's mainly about Yoav. If you don't remember the other names, not the end of the world. The interactions with David generally are, unfortunately, not so positive. The most extreme, where David gives the order not to kill Avshalom, right, under any circumstance, and who delivers the death blow to Avshalom? Yoav. And he even goes to the king to tell him more or less what he did. And, you know, David again says how he finds the sons of Tzeruiah very intimidating, or words to that effect. And in between, there may be other interactions. If you want to add something which will make me very happy, is to mention the beginning of Melachim, where Yoav joins the rebellion against David. So that's the final act of Yoav, which is essentially an act of rebellion.
Wait, what?
The son of David, Adoniyahu, rebels against his father. He's determined to kill David. And who joins the rebellion? None other than Joab. He's not a young man, but he's still powerful.
And two of David's sons rebel against him? Absolutely.
It's pretty terrible, yeah. Two of David. And then Amnon. What?
All of his sons.
Essentially, almost all of them. Except Shlomo. Except Shlomo. Yeah, we did discuss that. Why did David have, as my grandma would have said, no nachas from the kinder? Why did she have no joy from her children? And one of the things is clearly because he did not seem to focus on them the way he should have done. We explained, remember we said that two of his children, Avshalom and Tamar, were born from a woman that was captured in war, who was converted to become Jewish, and she represented a whole group of women who were taken in battle, were taken back to Israel, and taken back to their homes, and were sent back to their places where they came from. Normally, they would be there for a period of time, particularly if they were pregnant, because they were allowed to have relations one time, and that's part one of the laws of the Torah. It's a difficult law to explain, but it's there. And as a consequence, there were a lot of babies who were born who were abandoned. Because the women went home, they couldn't stand the kid, couldn't stand the husband, because they were, they came from Moab, they came from Ammon, they came from everywhere but from Israel. So they went home, but they left the children behind. So these children were abandoned, and David took them into the palace. The palace became, for want of a better word, a massive kindergarten service, a massive babysitting service. But of course that became a focus for David, who would take the challenge very well, but the family did not benefit. They actually seemed to have been ignored, certainly were never rebuked. And as a consequence, we have many of the stories of rebellion which are really quite disturbing. Why Avshalom and Adoniel particularly would absolutely admit that when they win their rebellion, they would kill their father is a pretty shocking thing for anyone to say. And they say it, right? We are prepared to go to the bitter end. And in the end, it was bitter because they both died. And David was determined, no, I don't want Avshalom to die. Who kills him? Yoav. Right? Almost as if Yoav does it, as you say in Hebrew, lahachis. He does it to annoy, to go to the extreme. And again, the whole discussion of Yoav and David throughout the book is very fascinating. Okay? And you can speculate a little bit. Maybe Yoav was jealous of David. Maybe, it's like the two members of the family, one does well, the other one doesn't, and maybe, the other one does well, but not as well as the first one, and there may be a certain sense of jealousy, I don't know. You can suggest a whole bunch of things about Yoav. Any suggestion I think is valid, if it's made with the right sort of respect, but at the same time, you can say something about it, whatever you think is appropriate. Okay, so I leave that to you to think about. Yeah. Seemingly, we on your note that I gave you, it says four occasions when Yoav killed people. Because later on he kills Amasa. When Yoav is demoted, he's not the leader of the army, after the rebellion of Absalom, he gets his job back by basically grabbing Amasa, who became the head of the army, by his beard. And again, the sword in the fifth rib. No recovery from that. You are instantly dead. And Amasa was killed, and of course David had no choice but to bring back Yoav. And at that point, seemingly Yoav... not exactly, because Yoav managed to keep outside the realm of rebellion, because that only happened really right at the end with Adoniel. That's after that. The rebellion that Yoav joined, he didn't join the rebellion of Avshalom, but he joined the rebellion of Adoniel, which is in Malachim. So it's later.
Yeah, but he still joined a rebellion.
Yeah, but that's much later, and that is sort of indicative of where Yoav was really at, but he doesn't get involved with rebellions until right at the end. Yeah, and that's when Yoav was killed. Yoav was actually put to death because of that.
Who was the other person he killed?
Avshalom, Uriah, and a guy called Amasa, Amasa, okay, who is mentioned there. It's chapter 19, if you want to look it up. Pretty terrible story. Yes, please.
Just a context question.
Yeah. Well, he did, and they all did that. But more than that, he basically anointed himself. He had people coming to not to Hebron, I think it was in Shechem, if I'm not mistaken. And, you know, the whole story there is pretty terrible. Really terrible. All right, number five. We're getting through this. Dovin and Batsheva. Some of the approaches, again, what I'm going to say is my three-pronged attack, if you want to remember it like that, which is, number one, to say that the approach of the secular world is to see this as a pure act of adultery, of lust, and other words that you want to use, sort of things that you may read in some of the novels that hopefully you don't read. But you know what I'm saying, it's sort of not necessarily anything more than that, and it shows David's weaknesses as a human being, and unfortunately a lot of the world looks upon it. I just had I saw a book over the Pesach holiday. My son bought a book which he thought was cool about the politics of David and Shaul. And this is the description. It's an Israeli academic who sees David behaving purely as a human being with lustful intentions towards Batsheva. When you read Chazal, you begin to realize that this can't be the whole picture. As I said, there's another extreme which sees David as Ish Kadosh, and therefore anything we read about him and Batsheva must not be taken at face value, right? Almost to the point where we can whitewash the whole story, which is a problem unto itself because it's there. There was an act of adultery. What I suggested to you is that there's an in-between situation where David behaves as a human being, for sure. Even though he's such a holy man, he has faults. And one of his faults is that when it comes to Batsheva, he is presumptuous. He's too quick. He's premature. He goes into a situation with Batsheva which he should have waited. He saw in her the potential to produce the next in the line leading to Mashiach, the next son who was going to take over, which obviously did, Shlomo. And that was something which he wanted to facilitate as soon as possible. So he takes her into his bed. He has relations with her. The baby dies. In the meantime, Uriah is sent to the front line. He's killed. And the whole story turns out to be very bad. I'll just finish my sentence. I'll take your question. Halachically, remember we said that David can justify his action. There may have been a bill of divorce, conditional bill of divorce, etc., as the Gemara says. But morally, and this is the point I think where it's really at, is that David realizes morally he did something terribly wrong. And Natan in chapter 12, this is chapters 11 and 12, Natan goes to him and says, in no uncertain terms, David, the story with the lamb belonging to the poor man, famous story, and David says that person deserves fourfold punishment, four times. And Natan says, the prophet says to him, it's you, David. You did this. David says, Chatati, but he had already pronounced the sentence. Four of his children were going to not survive. And you go through the list, Amnon, Tamar, Avshalom, and Adoniah. Right? All four in very different ways, but they all are affected by the behavior of David. So again, David can be understood as a great religious figure, as a great holy man, but with human fault, which I think is where Judaism is at. It doesn't say that every great rabbi had no faults, unlike Art Scroll, which seems to present these stories on a constant basis. Reality was, they did have faults. They weren't all perfect, but they were exceptional human beings. Right? And what the Torah demands of us is not necessarily perfection, halavai, but the Torah demands of us to be the best human being that we possibly can. And that's challenging. I'll just take Tova and then I'll come to Chana.
You don't count the baby that died there.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. I don't remember. Look at the notes and you'll see there's four occasions. Because Rashi brings it. And I'm pretty sure that actually may be one of them. It may be that Amnon is counted, but not Tamar. Because it's really part of the same story. So I think, and then the baby becomes the fourth thing that he loses. I'm pretty sure you're right. yeah, sorry, Chana. Yeah, his whole behavior with Batsheva, he brings it upon himself, because when he's talking to the prophet, he says, the person who takes the lamb, when they're talking about that story, should be punished four times. And the prophet, and Natan says to him, David, it's you. It's what you did with Batsheva. And David says immediately, one of the great things about David, he admits his mistakes, as you say in Ivrit, Alamakom. Right? Katati, he says immediately, as he does later on, the chapter we read last week, when he counts the Jewish people and he's wrong, and he immediately says, Chatati, should never have done it. Alright, so that's also interesting in terms of David's character. A man who is prepared to admit he is wrong as a leader. Right, halavai, we had leaders like that today. Yes, please, Alana.
Just, now I'm forgetting because I had a different question. Is there going to be a question on the census as well?
On what, sorry?
On the census. I don't see it here.
On which census are we referring to?
The census statement takes up the end of the book.
The census. It is sort of here because number 9, the end of the Sefer, David's second major sin.
His second major sin is considered the census.
Because of the census. So number 9 is chapter 24 of Shmuel Ben. Okay, it's just sort of in case you want to write down what chapter that is. Yeah.
Who is the prophet?
Nathan. Nat. Or whatever other word you want to call, used to describe it. Again, that was something. Look at Rashi's beginning of chapter 12. I'm pretty sure we're talking about, certainly about Avshalom. We're talking about Amnon, who is killed by Avshalom before Avshalom is killed. We're talking about Adonio later on. Right, that's the third child, and I think the suggestion is that it's also the baby that was conceived with Bathsheba.
Amnon and Tamar.
Avshalom and Tamar, because they're brother and sister. So
I
when
Amnon was the one who
raped Tamar. Yeah, Amnon is punished for a separate reason, but in terms of Tamar herself, again, does she die because of the story? I don't think so. She doesn't die from it. So it's really not Tamar at all. Tamar is a red herring. Apologies.
Instead of Tamar, it's the baby.
It's the baby. Instead of Tamar, it's the baby.
Also, the Ish Kodesh reason.
Yeah.
Can you just explain that?
Yeah, again, just to say again, the three positions. Either David is completely to be understood in secular term,
right,
that he's a human being with tremendous problem of lust and all that stuff. I mean, he's a very emotional man, no question about that. The other explanation would be to say Ish Kadosh, and they can't do anything wrong, and we have to reinterpret, right, that whole discussion from the Gemara. Anyone who says David's sin has made a mistake, please look up your notes on that. And then finally, what I consider to be the in-between position, which is to say, yes, human being with faults, but an amazing level of holiness was achieved, which I think really explains to me at least why I can relate to David. I can relate to him because at least as a human being, I relate to someone who, as holy as he was, also managed to make mistakes. And that's the human condition. That's what we all do, right? We try to aspire a little bit towards God, but we make mistakes. And we grow sometimes from those mistakes, hopefully all the time. Yeah?
I remember the question from before.
Yeah.
I've always heard throughout high school and later that David saw in Bathsheba the potential to be the mother of,
mother royalty,
whatever.
Correct.
But, okay, so are we presuming that he has some kind of, that when he saw her, there was, Ruach HaKodesh?
Correct. That's part of the explanation.
Because you can't just say that he, psychologically,
No.
All he did was saw her body.
He saw her body, and he saw her bathing, and she, according to Chazal, was very young. It's very strange to suggest that there's anything. So we have to talk about David in more spiritual terms, that don't call it nevuah, but let's call it some sort of, feeling, inclination, something that to him.
Didn't we say that the king had Ruach HaKodesh?
Yeah, again, Ruach HaKodesh, whatever you want to call it. Some say it is Nevuah. There's some sense, again, David with his relationship to God was completely in tune with these concepts of having an awareness. And with Bathsheba, he had that awareness. Now, does that justify taking her in the way he did? Clearly, the answer has to be no.
So all right? The only explanation would be at the very least. Biological one, oh, she's beautiful, so she would make a good mom.
Yeah, and that can't be the case.
When you read the details of it,
it just doesn't present itself like that at all. Again, I just want to mention Tehillim 51, which is so beautiful and describes David's conflict in his own mind, in his own neshama, about what he did with Bathsheba. David is tremendously conflicted. And there's no question that he knows, even though halachically he could stand up in court and justify himself, defend himself, morally he hasn't got a foot to stand on. And that becomes his issue. He does tshuva for the rest of his life, trying to recover from his moral mistake of morality that he made with Bathsheba. Quite amazing. David is amazing. I hope you realize how amazing he is. By the time you've done Shmuel Bet, this man is just off the charts. Yes?
Are we to assume that if
Mashiach is not coming at that point, but there is obviously the reason why they had to come together like that And seemingly it's because of the messianic process. There's a whole idea, really from the book of Ruth onwards, even before that, that Mashiach will come from liaisons, will come from relationships which on the surface look very dubious. Like Dovid and Bathsheba, like Yehuda and Tamar back in Bereshit, like the origin of Moab, which is Ruth, comes from incest. You know, all these things are very not nice. And yet, out of all of that comes Mashiach. So this idea of Ayin Hara, right? Mashiach will come from places which could have some sort of a bad eye, some Ayin Hara or Satan or whatever you want to call, looking at him. If he's coming from a pristine place, Mashiach, then the Ayin Hara will be involved. So he comes from a very dubious place. And then the Satan says, having nothing to do with that, you know, that's kind of not where Mashiach is coming from. Obviously, trying to fool the Satan, whatever that means. It's a Kabbalistic concept. But it does explain a lot of the messianic history. It's very strange. Just go on very quickly. Number six, Amnon and Tamar. What happened, the rape, etc. I just want to talk one thing about Yichud, the laws of Yichud which came out of it, which are really quite extraordinary. As I explained to you, for the 21st century, they are so relevant as they were right back in those days. Right, read the story, chapter 13. Amnon and Tamar, chapter 13. Sad, terrible story. And as a consequence, Avshalom prepares his revenge and manages to kill Amnon. Half-brothers don't get on very well. Number seven, the rebellion of Avshalom, the players. I showed you all the list of names. Just look that over. Don't have to remember everything, obviously. But, you know, if you're talking about the events, just good to know some of the names of the people in that particular story. The events and the question of David's supporters. Again, the whole thing of who supported him, who didn't support him, and particularly Shimi ben Gera, the whole interesting development there where Shimi ben Gera initially curses the king. He's a member of the tribe of Benjamin, Binyamin, coming from Shaul's tribe, and he says terrible things to David, and then David eventually forgives him, seemingly, by making him, as we said, the Rebbe of Shlomo. Unbelievable. Right? Again, something about David which is not necessarily in the text, but is quite extraordinary. Yes?
Wait, what chapter did you say?
Number seven, the rebellion of Avshalom, chapters 15 through 19. Four chapters. So again, read through the chapters and, you know, I'm not really going deeper than the actual story because the story speaks for itself. So that's really what you need to know about the rebellion. And of course, the tragic end and David's reaction, which is total devastation. You'd think that he knew Avshalom wanted to kill him, so he'd be relieved. Says David, Avshalom, b'ni Avshalom, he can't bring himself to speak. And along comes Yoav, interesting example of Yoav's interaction with David, and he drags him from his despair and says, David, in no uncertain terms, if you're seen to relate to Avshalom in this way by the public, they will lose faith in you because it looks as if you're really happy when your enemy was trying to kill you because you're crying about his death, even though it's your son. So Yoav says to David, pull yourself together. And David does. So he listens to Yoav at that particular moment and saves himself a little bit of a difficult situation. But of course, number eight, the rebellion of Sheva ben Bichri, chapter 20, where all of this goes completely out of the window again. Another rebellion against David. And remember what we said about Rabbi Soloveitchik, the whole discussion there was about the woman who kills Sheva ben Bichri. Sheva ben Bichri sets up a rebellion, he runs around the country, eventually he goes into a city where he holds himself up. He tries to create a kind of a mini state rebellion. And the woman there, Serach bat Asher, Serach, who is the daughter of Asher, mentioned in the Torah, she seems to be still alive, even though she's very old, to put it very bluntly. And nevertheless, she is able to kill, at least she claims she's able to kill Sheva ben Bichri to give him up in order to save the city. Which he does, throws his head over the fence, as it were. Not very nice, but she's a pretty tough lady. And we asked, how can she do that? Right? Is she allowed to? The king is allowed to kill a rebel, but is anybody else allowed to kill a rebel? And the answer is yes. Rabbi Soloveitchik said that there are two laws. One is about rejecting the king, rebelling against the actual king. And the other one, in this case, is rebelling against the house of David. And if you look at the language in chapter 20, it talks about Beit David. And therefore, when you are rebelling against the house of David, it's not just against David himself, but it's against the whole dynasty of David, then there is a separate halakha that anyone can come along to defend David to the point where the person can be killed. Now again, one ramification of this is obviously discussion that we had about Holocaust issues where these terrible things were done, where one person would have to be surrendered to save many people. Are you allowed to do it? In the case of Sheva ben Bichri, we can make a distinction. Sheva ben Bichri was a bad guy, so you gave him up to save the good guys, right? When it comes to in the Holocaust situation, nobody's a bad guy. So can you then just go and give up one person to save 100? And these were questions which were terribly, terribly difficult. Many people were in a situation where they said, we just can't give that person up. And of course, the Germans did not respect any of that anyway, and they would have killed the 100 whether you gave him up or not. But these were shilas, these were actual questions that were asked. There was a rabbi in the Lower East Side called Rabbi, what's his first name? Ephraim Oshry, O-S-H-R-Y. Wonderful rabbi who survived the Kovna ghetto. And in Kovna, when he was there, he was asked these terrible questions, impossible shilas. The Jews were asking him, because he was known as a rabbinical presence in the town, and they asked him questions. When you read the questions they asked him, you cry. Because how can that be a situation which he can remotely have an answer to? And one of them was about giving up hostages. And again, I think he might even refer to Sheva ben Bichri, saying that in that case it might have been allowed, but in our case, how can we? How can we give up one person to save 100 when we know, in the end of the day, that 100 will also be killed? And it was terribly difficult. Horrible, horrible things to have to make a decision. Yeah?
What did Sheva do?
He started rebelling. He said, David is not the king. Not the king that I want.
Declared
himself the king. He comes, I think, from the tribe of Binyamin, if I'm not mistaken. And therefore, we're back to the old chestnut, as they say, of Benjamin versus Judah. Right? Shaul HaMelech sort of comes along again. I pulled out the question that I'd had on other exams on chapter 21, the whole story of the 7 hostages that were given up. I'm not asking about that, but obviously be useful to know it. Number 9, the end of the Sefer, when we spoke about David's second major sin, counting of the Jews, and of course the buying of Aravna's land, the fact that he bought it, like Avraham Avinu, they bought these holy places so that anyone comes along in the 21st century, as many people have done and said, Jerusalem never belonged to the Jews. You can turn around and say, do you accept the account of the Bible? And they probably will say, yes, we respect the Bible. And then you would say to them, well, look what it says in the Bible. David paid good money. Didn't just take the land. I rather wanted to give it to him. David said, I want to pay for it. Because David knew that one day someone will come along and say, it doesn't belong to Am Yisrael, as they do today. It's horrible. And David knew this. And David made a tremendous statement. At the same time, David's sin of counting the people, sort of that story, just look at that story again. And the incredible statement there of Chatati. David admits his faults without question. He's a remarkable man. Even though there's a plague, the plague stops at the land of Aravna. It's kind of a siman of where the holy temple should be built. And David gets the message and buys the land. And that's the end of Shmuel Bet.
Wait, he pays Aravna for the land after the census and after the plague?
Yeah, after the plague. Because he's realized that was a siman, that's where the land of the temple has to B. That's the land that he has to buy.
And we say that the whole problem is that the census implies that there's too much of a focus on the military and too much of this, like, materialistic, like,
pride.
Yeah, we said that's one of the things we did mention is about the census, why it was so bad, is because he seemingly gave focus to his own ego. He was kind of massaging his own ego by saying, my army is bigger than yours. All right, sort of thing, and he wasn't really allowed to do that. David admits it, and he does repent that very quickly. Look at number 10, King David, his life, his trials, strengths, failures, other salient points, obviously everything, all the above, and whatever else you think you could want to add in. And why did he not build the first temple? 2 reasons we said. Number 1, a man of war cannot build a house of peace. And number 2, the man of holiness. If he builds the temple, he will face a situation, not him personally, but later on, where God is angry with the Jewish people, the temple remains standing, and God forbid, Am Yisrael disappears. The second one, the idea that if David would have built the Beit HaMikdash, he would have been so holy, it would never be destroyed.
Hashem would choose
to keep the temple and not not destroy the temple. And obviously, who has to be destroyed in place? God forbid, Am Yisrael. So the reality is David could not build the first temple for a number of reasons. I just compare it. Those of you who've been to Poland, you'll know about the yeshiva in Lublin, where the building is still there. It was built with such holiness by Ramesh Shapiro, the famous rabbi in Poland, that eventually that building survived, but the Jews of Lublin all gone. So that's like a siman of what we're talking about. Sometimes you put such holiness into a building, and that's not a critique of the rabbi. He wanted really to build the, make the statement about the yeshiva in Poland, but the tragedy was that it led to the destruction, not of the building, essentially, but later on, the people in Lublin, they were killed. It's really unbelievable. So again, there's a lot to say about, obviously, about David HaMelech. This is a fantastic story. I have to tell you, I think it's a bit crazy doing it all in one semester, but look what comes out from such a limud. Your appreciation of David. As I said at the beginning, when you go on a date with David, wow, now you understand how to prepare for that particular interaction. Right? He's very emotional. He's very intense. He's a bit kalbach. He'll sit there in the middle and do a kumzitz where you say, you know, what's going on here? All of a sudden, you've got 10 people sitting around strumming guitars. You know, big kippah over his ears. I mean, he's the kalbach, come Breslau, the whole works. Can one deal with such a man? As I said, very often, I would recommend go for Yonatan, much more stable. Bit sad, bit kingly. Prince, you know, do you want to deal with Prince William or Prince Harry? That's actually a good comparison. William, much more staunch, stiff sort of character. Maybe not in real life, but that's the impression. Harry, if you saw the announcement yesterday, unbelievable. What a guy. Interesting character. I nearly ended up teaching in the school where he was going to. He actually went to another school, but they said, Harry's coming here. And I said, oh, that should be very interesting, because that time he had a reputation of being a bit of a tearaway. And I was teaching a Jewish class. He may not have come to the Jewish class, but he may have, you know, we did a Hanukkah celebration where people could attend, and he may have attended, I don't know. But it wasn't meant to be, but I did meet Princess Anne once, so that was not the greatest experience, but whatever, you know. It's also one of the royal family, you know, you sort of rub shoulders with somebody. Putting it like that, I have to say to you again, thank you so much, everybody. Don't be late, as they say. Make sure you're there. Any questions, please don't hesitate. RebShaff@AOL.com, and look forward to seeing you in about 2 weeks or so. In the meantime, you know, happy exam preparation, etc., etc. Thank you, everybody. Thank you.